at worldgourmetfoods.com, bringing the taste of the world to Bloomington Normal.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about one of the most significant single battles in American history, the Battle of New Orleans, that took place in January of 1815 at the end of the War of 1812. And our guest for the program, Winston Groom, he is a well-known writer. He's authored a number of works of nonfiction. He's the author, in fact, of 13 books, 14, including the one we'll talk about this morning. He's probably best known for his novel Forrest Gump. He's also written others, including Better Times Than These, Shrouds of Glory, Conversations with the Enemy, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and also the book 1942, The Year That Tried Men's Souls, and the book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title is Patriotic Fire, Andrew Jackson and Jean Lafitte at the Battle of New Orleans. It has just come out here recently. It's published by Knopf. You can look for it in the bookstore. And if you're interested in American history, if you're interested in military history, it's a good story, and I would suggest you want to take a look at it. And, of course, as we talk here on the program, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455. That's the number here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Winston Groom, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. I guess in part your interest in the Battle of New Orleans comes from the fact that you had one of your ancestors fought in the battle, apparently fought, served with distinction, and was recognized for his service by Andrew Jackson.
Well, that's sort of true. actually, I had decided on writing about the Battle of New Orleans before I discovered all of that latter. What happened was I was casting around for some book to do, and I thought, well, you know, the War of 1812 in particular and the Battle of New Orleans specifically had really not been terribly well covered. And, of course, New Orleans, I'm in Mobile, Alabama, or rather across the bay from it in a little town called Point Clear. But New Orleans is a second home to me. It's only about 2.5 hours away. And so I was working on that, and I remembered that my grandmother had said to me when I was very, very young, she had mentioned, you know, her great-grandfather who had fought in the War of 1812, and that was about it. No mention of Battle of New Orleans, but my family had been for years pack rats, and all of this old material has sort of devolved through the generations down on me, stored in old lock boxes and strong boxes. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe there's something there, and I can see what he did. And I got all these papers out that dated back to the 1820s and 30s and 40s. And sure enough, lo and behold, here was my, let's see, great-great-great-grandfather, I guess, who did in fight, fact, he fought in the regular U.S. Infantry Regiment under Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans, and was what they called in those days noticed in dispatches. We didn't give medals in those days. They were considered the province of the British, who, you know, wore a lot of gold braid and medals and all that. And the Americans did not give out medals, but being mentioned in dispatches was the equivalent of a medal of some sort. So that's the way all that got started.
Mm-hmm. I think you make a good point about the War of 1812, and that is, you know, to the extent that people know our history, and I think all of us, myself included, we say we don't know it well enough, but the wars in American history that get the most attention are the Revolution and the Civil War. At the same time, I think there are a lot of historians that would argue, be prepared to argue, that in fact the War of 1812 had a very important role in shaping America and in creating in Americans the idea of America. It brought Americans together in a way that and unified them in a way that just hadn't been the case before.
Well, it sure did, David, and it also, I mean, psychologically, it was an enormous boost for the country, but it damn near tore it apart at first, and almost prompted a secession of the New England states. What happened was everybody was tired of British, basically, insults, such as impressing of American seamen and so forth. And the British, after the Revolution, was still smarting and angry that they had gotten put down by this upstart new country, when they can, you know, held the finest army in the world and the finest navy in the world, most powerful. And after one insult too many, President Madison had the Congress declare war on Great Britain. And the Americans, the first part of the war, or the first few months of the war, cheered this until the British came in with a blockade of American ports and the merchants couldn't get their goods out. And then the British landed an army in Canada and took over what is now the state of Maine. And then they sailed up the Chesapeake Bay and burned down our capital at Washington. And it looked like they were getting ready to take us over again. Mm-hmm. And the New England states, who depended on their livelihood from their shipping business, whether it was building ships or sailing ships out of their ports to foreign nations, were very angry about all of this, and actually called a convention, a secession convention, in Hartford, Connecticut, in 1814, with the notion of seceding from the United States and going back to the British Crown. And that convention remained in order until the Battle of New Orleans, after which the issue was rendered moot. So it really, for the first few years of the war, America was very despondent. It threw us into a huge economic depression because no goods were moving, and the farmers were taking their wheat and corn and feeding it to their livestock. It was that bad. Mm. So it was an interesting time in the history of this country, because you can see how, well, you can see it today, how American mood shifts. And the Battle of New Orleans in particular was a little more than just a battle for New Orleans. If you remember, in 1806, I think it was, Thomas Jefferson had purchased from the French all the territories owned by the French in west of the Mississippi River, which was the size of one half of the United States of America. And we owned that. I think it was $15 million, which is a pretty cheap price. Now you pay that for a condo. But the British diplomatic position was that transaction had been made by Napoleon Bonaparte, and the British, after defeating him, considered him to be an illegitimate ruler and a rogue, and their thought was that any international transaction that Napoleon had conducted was null and void. And so by taking New Orleans, which was the only outpost out there, because it was also the biggest city west of the Mississippi, but by taking New Orleans, the British conceivably could have then claimed the entire Louisiana Purchase lands for themselves and cut the United States right in half. So it was a fairly significant battle going into it. Mm.
Let me reintroduce our guest for this hour, Winston Groom. He's the author of a number of books, fiction and nonfiction, and we're talking here this morning about a book that he's authored. It's just recently out. It's about the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the War of 1812. The battle takes place in January of 1815. So we call it the War of 1812 because that's when it started. This was at the end. The book is Patriotic Fire, Andrew Jackson and Jean Lafitte at the Battle of New Orleans. It's published by Knopf, and and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, so as you've explained, by this time the war has been going along for a while, not going well for the United States. The blockade of the eastern seaboard has taken place by the British. Washington has been burned. Things are not looking well. And at this point now, the British set their sights on New Orleans. It was there early on, before it became clear that what the British plan of attack was going to be and where they were going to attack, was there some reason to question what exactly the British military objective might be and how they would go about trying to secure it?
Sure. That's a very good question. Everybody knew from basically spies that, well, first of all, it was common knowledge that the British had defeated Napoleon. And that freed up an enormous British army in Europe to come and polish off the Americans. And they had done their damage in Washington, and they had done their worst at Baltimore, where, if you remember, the writers, or actually who's an attorney at law, Francis Scott Key, wrote the Star-Spangled Banner after the Baltimoreans repulsed the British. But the British had many islands in the Caribbean, and there was much loose talk about a great British force descending in the Gulf of Mexico or the Caribbean. And so the powers that were at that time knew that the British were probably going to attack somewhere along the Gulf Coast, but they weren't sure where. Mobile would have been anybody's guess in the military. No, actually, Andrew Jackson said after the war that he said any military man would attack in Mobile and come to New Orleans across, by the landward side. But as it developed, these spies, some of whom were known as pirates, they were privateers and so on, they informed authorities in New Orleans that it was their belief that the British were going to attack New Orleans with a force of about 20,000 men, including sailors, from this big, it was actually the largest British fleet that had been in American waters, and a professionally trained army who had just defeated Napoleon of 10,000 men. And this was disturbing, to say the least, to the people in New Orleans, who had virtually no defenses and certainly no army. They had a few militia companies that were essentially ceremonial, meaning that they went out in fancy uniforms and drilled. Most of them did not speak the same language. They spoke French, they spoke Spanish, they spoke Creole, they spoke Cajun. And they were desperate for help and sent for some federal assistance, and the federal assistance came in the form of Andrew Jackson, who had a semblance of an army of Tennessee backwoodsmen and Kentucky backwoodsmen, with which he had just defeated the Creek Indians in Alabama. And so Jackson rallied to the cause and came to New Orleans and took a look at things and shook his head and, decided that the situation was very, very bad. And just about that point, it was reported to him that the British were landing troops on an island off of the Mississippi coast in preparation for an attack on New Orleans.
Let's bring Jean Lafitte into the story a little bit here. Before talking about how the British approached him and how then he passed the word on to the people back in New Orleans and how that all played out, because that's a great story. Let's just talk about who he was. He was a smuggler. He was a privateer. And apparently he had some friends and good customers in New Orleans who were interested in anything that he could bring in. He made a pretty good living for himself. He and his men were holed up in a place called Barataria, a bay out in the swamps, I suppose some people might have admired him. Some people might have just said he was a good businessman. Some people thought that he was a crook, a criminal, who probably should be in jail. The governor of Louisiana no doubt thought that, at least for a while. He certainly is a very, very colorful character.
Well, David, he was all of those. he was a very enigmatic man. I think the writer who I admire greatly, Frank Dobie, once said he must have been an enigma to himself. Lafitte was born in one of the islands, I think it was Hispaniola, which is now Haiti, which is then owned by the French, and had come to America with his brothers and took up a life of essentially privateering, which is one step above piracy. They received these letters of marque from various nations that were at war with one another to prey on enemy shipping and sink their ships or capture their ships, and then they were entitled to the goods. And what Lafitte was doing was carrying these goods to Grande Terre, which is a very lovely island right on the Louisiana coast, but far removed from New Orleans by water, which is the only way to get there because the rest of it was swamp. And he would, because of the British blockade of the Gulf ports, the British were getting, the Americans in New Orleans were getting nothing that they were accustomed to, such as fine wines and furniture and silver and so forth. And they were making a good living down in New Orleans. They had an enormous sugar industry. And the problem was that all their ships were sitting at the dock because they couldn't get out because the British fleet had been blockading them since about the beginning of the war. And so they were from the society, higher class citizens in New Orleans down to the poorest, they were grateful to Lafitte for bringing these goods. The problem was, in those days, there was no income tax in the United States. More's the pity. And the way that the country raised its revenue was on duties on foreign goods with a tariff. And Lafitte was taking these goods and selling them at cut rate because the tariff is about 30 or 40%. So he was selling them at 30 or 40% below face value, and people were buying them up like hotcakes. And this made the government angry because they realized that what they had on their hands was a smuggler. And so they sent a force down to Barataria to arrest Lafitte, a whole naval squadron. And they did not arrest him or his brothers. They arrested a few Barratarians, and the rest of them ran off into the swamps. But they captured, I think, 40 warehouses full of these goods for fashionable people and essentially wrecked his operation. And at the same time, the British, who really weren't familiar with the environs and New Orleans and approaches to it for a military operation, considered that Lafitte would probably be invaluable in helping them get through this maze of mires and swamps and bayous and rivers up to the city, because he knew it and they didn't. So they offered him a bribe of, I believe it was about 35,000 British pounds sterling, which today probably in the neighborhood of about $1 million, to lead them on a route that would be undetected by the Americans and let them capture New Orleans. And Lafitte, you know, he had a point at that a choice at that point of either sort of sailing off as a very wealthy man or helping America, which he had begun to consider his country. And you have to consider that Lafitte, being who he was, the kind of man he was, must have had some very profound thoughts on all this, because if he was caught by the British in betraying them, he was going to swing from a hangman's rope. But indeed, he did decide to help the Americans, and he was the one who first warned them that the British had approached him with a bribe and that they were coming by sea and so on. And at first, he wasn't believed, but they soon found reasons to believe him, because the British were actually seen landing on Ship Island out there.
Yeah.
So Lafitte played a major role there just in warning the Americans.
It's a great story here. You can just imagine this, the British coming to pay a call on Lafitte and offering him all this money. And Lafitte apparently said to them, okay, I'll work with you guys. I'll get back to you in a little bit here. So the British sail away, and then immediately Lafitte writes to someone he knows in New Orleans and said, look, the British were just here. They offered me all this money. They're going to invade. You know, I think we ought to do something about this. And as you say, back in New Orleans in the office of the governor of Louisiana, they didn't believe him. Apparently then also Lafitte wrote to Andrew Jackson directly, offering to help him out, to fight with him in exchange for a pardon. And Jackson turned him down because he thought he was scum.
Well, he was under invasion. A warrant. In other words, Jackson said, this man, Jackson, you know, everybody portrays Jackson as some kind of clod. He was a judge in Tennessee. He was a lawyer, and he knew the law, and he said, this Lafitte is under a warrant from the civil authorities, and I'm a military man, and I have, you know, the civil people can do with him what they wish, but I can't, I'm not going to hire, you know, someone to work with me. This is what he first said. I'm not going to hire somebody to work with me. Who was under what essentially was an indictment. But you brought up a very good point in the beginning of your question there, which is what Lafitte told the British when they offered him the bribe, and he said that he would see if he could work something out with them, and he said, I'll get back to you. Now, that was the origin of the expression that is now used from Hollywood to corporate America. I have noticed it many, many times. I'll get back to you. And so he delayed them until it was too late. But what he did was not only forewarn the Americans, but over the years he had stored up a lot of gunpowder and a lot of flints. In those days, the rifles and muskets were, their firing mechanism had to contain a piece of flint, and they didn't have any flint in the warriors. They had like stone pebbles, but that's not a good, that wouldn't fire very well. The flint is a special rock that when it hits the firing pan will produce a spark, and the spark sets off the gunpowder, and it propels the bullet out and kills somebody, hopefully. But he had all these, whereas none of these in the warriors, nor did the people in the warriors have cannons, which were becoming extremely effective at that stage of warfare. That he had not only cannons on his ships, and at any given time he'd have 15 to 16 large ships in the Barataria area unloading goods or just resting up or whatever, and each one of them probably contained anywhere from, you know, 2 to 20 guns, big cannons. But he had trained cannoneers, which New Orleans didn't have. And the only cannon that Andrew Jackson had with him during the entire Creek campaign was a little six-pounder, which is like a pea shooter. They're talking about 24-pounders here, which is a very effective gun at long range.
And that's the weight of the ball, when you think about it.
That's the weight of the ball or the shell, whichever it is. And so he was instrumental in getting all of that to Jackson, plus his Barratarians knew every inch of that swamp because they were smuggling everything from coffee to fine linens to everything else, and they knew how to avoid the Americans. And so he was pretty much able to cover his area in Barataria. Unfortunately, the the British didn't land in Barataria. They landed east of there, came through what is known as Lake Bourne, which flows into Lake Pontchartrain, which, of course, we all know is what flooded New Orleans during the recent storm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a long peninsula down there in Plaquemines Parish. And one little bayou, which is essentially a creek, led up to a plantation. These were all sugar plantations that lined the Mississippi River. And they were very complicated and elegant places. I mean, the structures were had been built as mansions, more or less, like the old southern plantations of the later period. But practically every one of them had some sort of water egress into Lake Bourne, because the Mississippi winds so much, it took a terrific amount of time to get from New Orleans down to the mouth of the Mississippi. It's like just S-curves and S-curves, where if you could get from your plantation from the rear of it into Lake Bourne, you were out in the Gulf, and kaboom, you were gone. And unfortunately, Andrew Jackson had ordered all of these sloughs and bayous and creeks to be blocked by felled trees so the British couldn't get landing boats in there. And one of these had been neglected. And sure enough, that was the one that the British picked with the aid of some traitorous Spanish fisherman who lived at the mouth of it. And so suddenly Jackson was taken completely by surprise when reports came that the British had landed.
One other thing, just to talk about, sort of go back a little bit to talk about this relationship between Jackson and Lafitte. We talked about the fact that when Lafitte tried to warn the government in New Orleans initially about the British invasion, they didn't believe him.
Right.
Then when they found out that he was right, and this was already after he had offered to fight with Jackson, and Jackson said, well, this man's a criminal. I'm not going to work with this guy. Then after they realized that the invasion was indeed imminent, then apparently the governor of Louisiana went to Jackson and said, look, please, this man is still offering to help. We need his help. Jackson said no again, but it wasn't until he actually met Lafitte in person that he apparently decided he liked the look of him, that he looked okay. He didn't look like a pirate, and so he thought, well, all right. And maybe he felt, as you mentioned, that since he had shot, he had powder, he had flints, he had cannon, he had men, and perhaps Jackson thought, well, I think we could use all of these things, so perhaps perhaps we'll ignore his past and we'll say okay.
Well, Jackson was a very practical man. Among other things, he had to, if you lived out in Tennessee in those days, you had to be a practical man. But I think that definitely, you know, Jackson was probably expecting when he met Lafitte, you know, some guy to come in there with a bandana around his head, wearing pantaloons and a sword, and an earring in his ear, and so on. And here is introduced Lafitte wearing, you know, fine clothes. He was a tall man. Tan, very good-looking man in his 30s, very well-spoken, spoke English, French, Spanish, Italian. And his persona was such that it impressed Jackson that this man could probably be trusted, or could be trusted. And so he made him one of his principal aides during that period. One of his duties was to make sure the British didn't try to get in through Barataria, but the other one was to help Jackson just with everything that he was trying to do. And the whole episode was only about 2.5 weeks. It was began in December of 1814, when the British landed at the end of December. And, of course, when Jackson learned this, you know, much to his credit, I don't know, there's no way of telling, it'll all be speculation, but what other generals would have done is, you'd have to guess it. But Jackson said, as soon as he learned that the British had landed, he said, by God, they shall not sleep on our soil. And he got every troop he could find and attacked the British that very night as they were still landing, which was a brilliant tactic because an amphibious landing, they were landing, they had to row, the British had, 60 miles from their base at near Lake near Ship Island across Lake Bourne in the wintertime, and then land there in this little bayou on this plantation. But an amphibious landing is probably the most dangerous military maneuver that can be undertaken. It's like the landing at Normandy or in North Africa. It's very, very dangerous to be caught. And Jackson caught them, but it was nighttime, and of course there were no lights. And the Americans went at these guys, and I say Americans, a lot of these people fighting for Americans spoke only French or they spoke only Spanish. But they went at them with tomahawks and knives against the British swords and bayonets, and they had at it in a man-to-man fight there on the sugar plantations along the Mississippi for about 4 hours. And the British were absolutely astonished by the ferocity of the American response, because when they had assaulted Washington, which was the nation's capital, the militia, which is what Jackson's men were, had run off and just let the British march right in and set fire to everything, including the White House, the Capitol, Library of Congress, everything. And one of the British officers who was later killed remarked, he said, I'll have to paraphrase, I don't remember exactly. He said, these people do not behave like militia. And the result of that battle was it left a lot of dead British soldiers and a lot of dead Americans as well. But Jackson finally called it off because everybody was getting tired at that point, and the British were landing more and more men, and he didn't have at that point enough force to contain them, because Jackson was still getting troops coming in from Alabama, and they hadn't arrived yet. So he pulled back for about a mile upwards toward New Orleans, which is only about 8 miles from the city itself. And he established himself a defensive line along an old canal, and he had his men dig out the canal, which was at that point in disuse, and it was overgrown with weeds, and they dug it deep so that they could flood it from the Mississippi to serve as more or less of a moat. And the spoil that they took out of the canal, they threw up behind it for a defensive line. And they began to emplace their guns there, and that line ran. It was called Jackson's Line. It was his first line of defense. It ran from the Mississippi River to a cypress swamp that was virtually impassable. And it ran for about three-quarters of a mile, and with cannon emplacements about every, or cannon batteries every 100 yards or so. Some of them were longer, some of them were shorter distances. But he set himself up pretty good defensive line there against these British. And at one point, Lafitte was riding with Jackson and looking at the line, and he noticed something that gave him a shiver. He didn't like it because he said, your line, General, that runs in the cypress swamp simply ends, what we call in military having your flank up in the air. And he persuaded Jackson, and Jackson agreed with him entirely, to bend this line back so that the British couldn't somehow sneak through that cypress swamp and get behind the American line. But Jackson was pretty secure at that point.
Let me introduce again our guest, We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, too. I'm talking this morning with Winston Groom. He's the author of a number of books, fiction and nonfiction, probably best known for his novel Forrest Gump. His new book is Patriotic Fire. It's about the Battle of New Orleans, and it's published by Knopf. It's out now in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone listening in Edgar County, not that far away, on our line 4. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Good morning.
Hello. Yes.
The rain stopped.
Good. Rain stopped?
For the, well, we'd had some heavy rains here this morning in our area.
Listen, send it down here. We've been in a drought. We're the rainiest city in America. We get 80 inches a year for it in Seattle. We've been in a drought for 6 months.
Winston, we'll send you the rain.
I'd appreciate it.
Winston, you and I met back in 95 at the James Jones Literary Society.
Oh, yes.
And you and I talked about Truman.
Capote or the president?
Well, anyway, Truman Capote.
Yeah, he was a good old buddy of mine. I liked old Truman.
Yes, I didn't know him until the last years of his life, so, you know, it wasn't quite the same, I don't think. But anyway, the thing is that I just, you know, wanted to call and say hello. To be honest with you, I'm learning a great deal about New Orleans, you know, War of 1812, because I wasn't that up on it. I did read your book that you published last year on the first year of the World War II.
Yes.
And also I have your Forrest Gump recipe book.
Well, I have to tell you, I didn't write any of those recipes.
Well, but you got them from the family, right?
Oh, hell no. I tell you what, Southern Living published that book.
Right, yeah.
They said, can we'll pay you a bunch of money to have you, you know, have your name on it and all that. Well, I consider myself a cook. I mean, a chef of Southern foods. I can cook the best shrimp creole and gumbo. As a matter of fact, I was over in New Orleans a couple of years ago before the storm and the great chef's cook-off from all the states. And so, anyway, I had great notions of doing that. And was promptly informed by the people at Southern Living, no, sir. we have to test every in our business. They got a huge operation there in Birmingham. We have to test every recipe, and then we have like chemical labs and all that kind of business. Because if you put a recipe in the book and somebody says it made them sick or killed them or something, they're liable for it. So they said, no, we'll put the recipes in. You just write the introduction and let us use your name.
Well, all my illusions about you being the next Julia Child are now completely smashed.
No, I'm an utter fraud. But, you know, I still get royalties from that book, so that's good.
Also, I was sorry that next day that you weren't able to go with Kylie Jones and I to see James Jones' house at Marshall.
Well, I had seen that, actually.
Pardon?
I'd been there years before. I was coming back from, I lived for about 8 months in Vail, Colorado, and I came back through, and I called up, I guess, Gloria Jones, his widow. And
yeah, she just passed away.
Yeah, and he had just really within a year, I think, he had passed away. Well, Gloria passed away just recently, too.
Just last month, yeah.
She went, I'll tell you, she went like she wanted to go with a bottle of scotch. So she's
Sagaponic.
Yep, she's neat.
Yeah.
One of my best friends. But anyway, I did sort of see that, but that was back in about
77, 78, right.
But I think we had to get on down the road after that. But that was a very nice experience to meet everybody in the James Jones Society.
Yeah, it was very. It's a good society, and also being able to spend, you know, Sunday with Kylie was nice. And if you see her, say Gary says hello.
Well, I've been talking to her a lot since her mom died.
Yeah.
She's doing well. She's teaching writing at Columbia University.
Right. Yeah.
Writing books and trying to straighten out that big house out in the Hamptons, and She's doing fine.
It's a beautiful place out there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Well, it's been ruined now, but you know, nobody can do anything about it.
Yeah.
All the, you know, the movie people got there. When the writers and the artists were there, it wasn't so bad. And then the movie people started moving in and paying, you know, $10 million for a house and building houses and all the potato fields. And it's so crowded you can't move. But anyway, you know, life goes on.
It's not like it used to be 30 years ago.
Yeah, well, I think I got, I'm looking at my wife. I better get on with this battle in the
yes.
Williams.
Well, anyway, it's nice to talk with you, and I will look forward to reading the book.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Great.
Indeed.
Good to hear from you.
Our guest this morning, Winston Groom, and the book we're talking about is Patriotic Fire, and it's about the Battle of New Orleans. Well, you talked a little bit about the run-up to the battle in the December of the 1814, and the battle itself takes place in 1815, and talked about the fact that when Jackson heard that the British were landing, he decided to take the fight to the British. He wasn't going to sit there and let them land completely unobstructed. That helped to slow them down so he could throw up some defenses, because there really wasn't, the city really had nothing. And it comes to the point where the battle occurs, and it seems that it's one of those examples where a key mistake makes all the difference, and that when the British approached, they didn't have what they needed, what they would have needed to actually mount an attack on these earthworks that Jackson had thrown up, and the result, the fire from the Americans, from small arms and from artillery, just devastated the British. It just mowed him down, killed a lot of officers. It was a devastating defeat for Britain.
Well, it was, and the British attacked. Well, they had actually two attacks of different sorts. They had first they wanted to try the line. They had finally their principal general, General Pakenham, who was the brother-in-law of the Duke of Wellington, arrived, and his first assessment of the situation was, how in the hell do we get into this mess with, we're in a triangle bordered on a river and a swamp? But he tested the Americans' line and found it to be impregnable, so the British went back and regrouped, and they got a lot of big artillery off of these ships and began what was known as the artillery duel, and the Americans beat them at that too. But now Christmas had passed, New Year's had passed, and the British had massed with, again, yet more reinforcements for a final charge, and they were going to simply swarm over the American line, Jackson's line, and overwhelm them and march right into New Orleans. But unfortunately, they first had to get through the line. And one of the interesting things was that the British tactic in those days, from Napoleonic days and even further back than that, was simply to mass men in a formation and march. And the idea was, do it in the daytime, do it when you can frighten the enemy simply by your red coats and the fact that you march so smartly and that you're not going to run away. And that's usually somebody else ran away from them. But the weapon of choice for the British was a musket, a rather short barrel weapon. So they had to get within a range of about 100 yards in order for that gun to be, that rifle to be, or it's not a rifle, it's a musket. It's not rifle barrel, so that's why it's a smoothbore gun. It only has an effective range of 100 yards. Well, the Americans there, and by this time they were the Kentucky and Tennessee backwoods squirrel hunters, they came with their Kentucky long rifles that were rifled and had an effective range of 300 yards. So they could start picking off the British long before the British could start picking off them. And then some very interesting things began to happen more or less all at once. The regiment, it was an Irish regiment, that was supposed to bring the scaling ladders and what they call fascines to get across the moat so that they could go over the line, had forgotten them. And in this confusion, General Pakenham, who was the leader of the British, went forward to see what was going on, and he was shot and killed. About the same time, the other two British major generals were also either shot and or killed. So the British were out, they ran out of generals. And nobody quite knew what to do at that point. The Irish had run off, and once the other British saw a regiment running off, they were getting this very heavy fire, both from the cannon, some of which were manned by Lafitte's men, others manned by Americans. They saw this happening, and they ran off too. It was a very ignominious defeat for the British. And the scene has been described so vividly, you hesitate to go into it on a radio program, but Jackson himself said, and again paraphrase, he said it looked like the resurrection. He said when the smoke cleared, the field was almost a sea of red, and it wasn't blood, it was the redcoats who had fallen. And then he said a scene as out of the resurrection. All these British soldiers began to rise up, not all of them, but about a third of them, which would number in the hundreds, if not thousands, who were either wounded or who had hidden behind the bodies of their dead comrades, began to raise up and walk toward the American lines with their hands in the air. And so the British then went back to their camp a mile away and tried to think of what to do. And in the end, they could think of nothing but getting out of there. And so they conducted a ruse where they stuffed a lot of British uniforms with hay and put them on sticks so that it looked like they were still there. They lit the campfires and then sneaked off and got back in their boats and successfully went back home. Mm. Otherwise, Jackson would have bagged a whole bunch of them. So that's how he won the Battle of New Orleans, which ironically did not end the War of 1812. The War of 1812 had been ended 2 weeks earlier, but the message had not gotten across the ocean by ship that it had, so the battle itself was actually fought after the war had ended. But there's a good deal of very well-documented speculation that had the British carried New Orleans, all bets were off. I mean, the British diplomacy in those days was very, very shifty, and it's not exactly straight today, but they would probably have retained New Orleans and the Louisiana Purchase land as some kind of bargaining chip or something, or tried to keep it. So it was still a very important battle, not just some sideshow or afterthought.
Yeah, one should well keep in mind, and unfortunately we're coming down to the point here, we have about a minute or two, just what this would have meant to the British having perhaps the world's greatest hardened, battle-tested army coming off of the Napoleonic Wars, going up against this bunch of ragtag irregulars and backcountry woodsmen led by Andrew Jackson with the assistance of the Barataria pirates. You know, the British must have thought there was no way that they could lose. And for them to have lost to this bunch led by Andrew Jackson must have been just crushing.
Well, they still don't talk about it much till this day. I can tell you that in my research, when you look through the British documents and also the few British books that have been written on this subject, they are mostly books of speculation as to how the British could have won it rather than, you know, how they lost it. And those books give little credit to Jackson, but that's normal. I mean, you know, every side in the war has got his ox to gore, and the British, though, they still had Wellington, and they still had conquered Napoleon, and were secure in their island kingdom and with their fabulous colonies all over the world. And so it didn't really affect the British other than a sort of bitter taste in their mouth for a while, and then they went on and forgot it. And within a few years, they were actually trading and doing diplomatic business with the United States far more than they ever had done before. And they also quit doing those, insulting our Navy and impressing our men for their sailors. So all's well that ends well.
Well, we know what happened to Andrew Jackson. He, not immediately, but after this, went on to become President of the United States. What happened to Jean Lafitte?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Requires a long time to answer, but there are so many stories about what happened to him. I mean, it depends on what you read. I mean, he was either, you know, killed by his own men in the 1820s. He died at sea. He was captured by the Spanish and hanged. He was lost at sea in a ship. He was killed by American forces when he went back to privateering or pirating or whatever it was somewhere. What actually, he went actually from Barataria. He still wanted money from that the Americans had taken from him down there on Grand Terre Island from all those goods that he had. But he lost the lawsuits in the courts. So he got back into privateering business, but he took the business over to the port of Galveston, Texas, and operated there for years. And then a hurricane came and wiped them out. And he went back to sea, and there is no firm documentation, authenticated documentation, other than his memoirs, which were written in the late 1840s and 50s, that are now in a repository at the Houston Library. They were written in French, translated not too well by the Ursuline nuns and the Woyans, where he says he went, after all of this, changed his name to Laffin because he didn't want to be known as Lafitte, and went to Alton, Illinois, which is right near, what's that town up there? I get my geography mixed up in Illinois. A big city in Illinois on the Mississippi River.
I'm sorry. I've got to jump in on you, Mr. Grimm, because we